All right, the Williams case.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Keith Vergara, and I do represent Charleston Williams. Please, at the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
5 minutes, yes, sir.
We come to the court today on the case of value, whether or not the laptop, as it was put into evidence, is worth $200 or more. We have some legal points, and I think we have some factual points here. I'll begin with the most legal of them, and I would argue that the evidence as it was espoused was improper to properly form the foundation for $200 or more. We would argue that the only evidence that is actually in the record is the valuation given as $800 or more during the colloquy with the judge, because the judge had sustained an objection striking all the evidence prior to that, because it was based on something someone else had told him as opposed to his own opinion as the owner. So our argument would be, first, that the $800 or more that he answered to the judge, and then under cross-examination, he specifically said that he got that value based on that's what they would sell it for new.
So your position is that, and it's not entirely clear reading the transcript exactly what was going on given the back and forth, that everything that Mr. Temper testified to as to value prior to the court saying I'm granting the motion disappears from the record?
Well, certainly I think the objection was specific as to his valuation. But yes, we would argue that his testimony as to value, it disappears from the record. We would also argue further on that even if that's not true, that we can overcome that problem as well. But our position is that all of his testimony as to value was stricken from the record by that objection and that objection being sustained. And in that case, it's clear on page 44 of the appendix, when asked where that value came from, he said that's the price that we would sell it at new. And the case law is very clear that the price when something's new, the price that you purchase for, is not the proper valuation. It's a fair market value. It's the present value.
But it can be accepted as evidence. And a classic example would be if you spent $500,000 on a Ferrari, and it was stolen. Even if it was 5 years old, everybody would concede that that one's worth $200.
Yes, Your Honor, that's certainly true. However, unlike a Ferrari, which is something more akin to gold or a diamond that holds its value, this is a computer. And computers are among the technological things that the court has specifically found devalue quickly, and therefore other information is needed. All of the information we have for that purpose is awful. And any of the information that would be helpful is missing. As instance, in the Ferrari situation, at least we know how old the Ferrari is. In this case, there was never reduced how old the computer is. And so we would argue that the testimony, while it may possibly be considered as what the original value was, is so far afield from what the case law requires as to proof of present fair market value, considering all the evidence, it is just insufficient for the court to reach that on that basis.
Does it matter that the store manager testified that he discovered it was missing while doing an inventory? Inventory, of course, being capable of being defined as goods or items that a store holds for sale, or in this case, I guess, sale or rent.
I don't think it adds anything, because what we're talking about is that what the present condition and present value of the present value of the laptop, which is entirely dependent on its present condition. And the evidence in this case is that the store owner never inspected it, he never opened it, he never turned it on, he never did anything that would allow him to gauge in any way, shape, or form what the present condition of the laptop was.
Well, in fact, wasn't there evidence undisputed that the cord and battery pack were missing from this laptop?
Yes, both the cord, which was the power supply, and also the battery were missing, so they were not available. There's no information as to what software was originally contained on the computer, which is part of the value, and it may have been completely wiped because the computer was never turned on, which leads us to another problem, is we don't know if the computer is even working. I've never had I've never had used a visual aid in an argument like this before, but I was sorely tempted this morning to bring my laptop from when I was in law school. It no longer has a battery, and I would have left the power cord home, and I can honestly tell you, I don't know if it works.
Has it ever been in a freezer?
It has never been in a freezer. That's what it was. I couldn't testify that it was roach infested, and I didn't want to, you know, mislead the court. But that's the problem with trying to get the value from its original new value, is it's about as far from new as we can possibly get, and so we would argue that the evidence of what it was originally sold for is insufficient as a matter of law under the case law. Just briefly, if the court wants to consider some of the previous testimony, the interesting part in that would be his statement that even with the battery and the power cord missing, is it still worth more than $200 to you? I would argue that one should specifically not be considered by the court, because at that time, if you go back in the appendix, he wasn't sure whether it was an AP, an HP, or an Acer computer. He wasn't sure what computer he was talking about at that point, and he specifically was relying on information that somebody else had given him as opposed to his opinion as owner. Additionally, we argue that the question is improper. The question is not what the value of the laptop is to him, which is specifically what was asked, but what the fair market value is.
Well, and in general, I think that observation would be credited, but we don't have somebody who's attaching subjective value to something in the sense of emotional attachment. We're talking about a merchant who is in the market of renting and selling these machines, so isn't a value, could a fact finder hearing that testimony, assuming it's not stricken, assume that it was market value because he has them specifically for the purpose of buying and selling them, so the value to him is their market value.
Well, here's the problem with that. While he may not attach particular emotional value to it, he may be able to, if he just throws it away or has to write it off as a loss, the taxation, the discount on his taxes may be worth $200 or more, whether someone else is or not is really willing to pay that. So a write-off as a loss for a businessman is another source of value that is not fair market value, but would be of value to him. And since that type of thing is available to the store owner, I don't think we can completely write off the idea that this has more value to him than it may have on fair market value. Next, I'd like to touch briefly just on the weight of the owner's opinion generally. This gets back to, I mean, we still argue that the his opinion should about whether what it's worth, $200 or more, should have been stricken. But if the court decides to include that, I'd ask the court to remember that the original line of cases on this, which is, I mean, we quoted Haynes, originally began with the idea that, well, he should certainly be allowed to testify, but, you know, based on what his knowledge is, that the weight of that testimony might often be trifling, and that's what I think I'd like the court to focus on today. And it's not many of the cases that have come after that have focused on more of what the owner's knowledge is of present market values. What those cases have not changed in any way is the bedrock foundation of this idea in the first place. It's because of the owner's relationship with the property that he has knowledge of it. In this case, the owner of this laptop no longer has any knowledge of this product because it has been, for a time of unknown length, out of his control, out of his sight. He does not know if it's in brand new condition, if it's completely broken. It has been completely out of the relationship, so to speak. And so this is the perfect type of case where the court must look and decide what his knowledge is and how that affects the weight. And then once we start to do that, we realize that he has no legitimate basis for knowing what this is. He even basically testifies to it as, you know, well, I know it's worth this because that's what we would have originally sold it for. And because of the time that has elapsed, it would be a very different situation indeed if he had inspected it when it had come in or if he had some knowledge. Then the lapse in time would not be as important. But since there is no reconnect, there is no, you know, reliving, you know, re-engagement of the relationship, he is devoid of the very relationship that line of cases bases that admissibility on, and we would argue that is the reason that his especially in light of the other factors, that the weight of that testimony, if the court does decide to include it as part of the record, it should not have been given enough weight to consider.
Wait, that's a tough issue on appeal, second-guessing the weight given by the trial court.
Your Honor, I agree, but I think this probably is certainly the most outlier of a case that I've ever seen, where we've got this much evidence about the condition of something, and it's this blaring that the condition of this property makes his valuation. And we do, of course, he has a bias in this because he wants it to be worth more than $200 so he can get more than $200 in restitution. But I think this is such an outlier that it overcomes, we could argue, that the judge is plainly wrong.
And I know you want to save some time for rebuttal, but in Dunn, we have a situation where the Supreme Court says, you bought the typewriter new for $150, it's 10 years old. We're not comfortable saying that a jury could conclude that it hadn't lost at least a third of its value. Here, in your case, you need to show that to be equivalent, we have to find that it lost something like 80% of its value.
However, we don't know what the time frame is. Certainly, if it was a 20-year-old laptop, it would be worth basically nothing. It can't run anything.
It might have good museum value if it were 20 years old.
I agree, but now we've reached the speculative point that I think I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Johnson?
Good morning again. I'm Victoria Johnson from the Attorney General's Office. First of all, Your Honors, as to the evidence itself, we know that the trial court reconsidered its determination on striking the evidence because at Appendix 63 to 64, the judge specifically relied on the testimony at issue. At 63, the prosecutor was talking again about the evidence of depreciation. And he says, Mr. Temper, the owner, testified that the laptop was well over $200 to him, the owner. That's at 63 lines 6 to 7. He goes on to say, he said the property was worth over $800 new, and the Commonwealth went as far as to ask, even without the power cord, even without the battery, is it still worth more to you than $200? The owner of the property said, yes, it's worth over $200. That's about line 15, going through about line 15.
Wouldn't that even be evidence of an error if the court is relying on evidence that it had struck back at, what it was, at page 43, 44 of the joint appendix?
No, Your Honor, that evidentiary issue remained in the rest of the court. The court can reconsider that.
Well,
the court heard further argument and reconsidered it.
But isn't the problem with arguing that the court considered the $200 evidence that you're relying on counsel's argument to the court to ferret that out? Because this is not the court saying this, this is the assistant Commonwealth's attorney saying this, and I've been in courtrooms where attorneys argue things that weren't in evidence all the time.
But I hadn't turned the page yet, Your Honor. At page 64, at line 4, the court says, overrule the objection, as Mr. O'Brien said.
Well, right, but the objection there won.
They're talking about the same objection.
Well, it seems to me they're talking about an objection about whether the owner can give a value.
And that has been the same. That's been the same continuing discussion throughout. That was the issue at trial. The issue at trial was whether the owner could give the value. The owner gave the value, and then it was moved to strike, and there was this long conversation. And about page in the 40s, I apologize, I should have noted that down. The court said, I strike the evidence, and the Commonwealth says, you're striking as evidence? And then we have, I read it with spirit, and then we have this other long discussion.
I'm confident Mr. O'Brien said it in about that tone of voice.
I think so. It's at page 41. They have more of a discussion, and the court says, well, all right, I sustain the objection. And that's at page 41, line 10. At line 13, the Commonwealth says, I'm sorry, you strike his objection.
Strike his testimony.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you strike his testimony. I apologize.
Right, that's right.
And then...
But then the court answers, you refreshed, it's a compact, but nothing else about value.
And then the Commonwealth says, well, Your Honor, he never needed to refresh his recollection as to the value. He stated the value of the item was $860 or more. Yeah, but then there was this difficulty about what kind of computer it was and Later on, there was, and then the court asks, you know, they have this discussion, and then at page 42, line 10, the court asks, Mr. Temper, if this is a compact computer, what's your opinion of the value of this computer? And they talk about the, he has this business record called a perpetual. So he's basing this on the business record, and he finally says, it was over $800, that satisfies it.
Well, but then on cross, Mr. Temper concedes that the over $800 is the $866 of when it is sold new. You concede that this was, I don't know
right,
exactly how a computer
value.
Gets roach infested, but this one's not new.
Right. This is not new. It's been rented out and come back roach infested. And apparently ColorTime has a procedure to take care of that. That apparently works for them. And however, though, the issue is re-raised and re-argued, and the judge relies on that $200.
Where does the judge say he's relying on the statement that it's worth more than $200 as opposed to saying that they've just established it's worth more than $200 based on the, it's worth more than $866, it's $866 now?
Page 64. Line 4. And he refers back to the Commonwealth's argument. And the Commonwealth had been arguing that the $200 value was in. And I submit that the trial court.
Well, he also said the property was worth $866.
He said that it was worth $866 new. And then, even without the power cord and the battery pack, it was worth $200 to him. In its current state at the time it was stolen. And that's the evidence of value.
What is his basis for, there's no evidence as to how old it is?
That's
is that correct.
Correct?
There's no evidence as to whether it works.
Well, it was stolen before anyone could turn it on.
So there's no evidence as to
correct.
Whether it works, and there's no evidence as to what its properties are, what it can do, what software is on it, anything.
That is a fair representation of the record before the court.
But there is evidence that the power pack and electric cord were missing.
Yes, that is correct. They were removed. I think that they were sitting on the dryer in the, they were still at the store.
I think they were removed before they went into the freezer.
That's correct. For the deep
and you would concede that diminishes its value.
Yes, and that was part of the Commonwealth's evidence of depreciation. That was part of the question. Even in its current state, at the time it was stolen, without the battery pack, without the power cord, and with some roaches, what is it worth to you?
Wayne Easter and Omari.
More than $200.
Wayne Easter.
And that's the evidence of record.
If we conclude that that was stricken, do you concede you lose?
Well, if it was stricken, there's no evidence.
Well, I mean, you would have the $866 new. If that's all that's in, is
then
that enough?
Then there's no evidence of depreciation. And the Commonwealth has the burden to show depreciation. However, that evidence was not stricken. The trial court expressly relied on that evidence. That evidentiary ruling was still within the breast of the court. The court could reconsider it during the trial, and the court did so. And you can tell the court did so because it expressly relied upon it. At page 64. Line 4 and 5. That evidence is before the court. The court relied upon it.
And actually, line 14 and 15 as well, the court, I still think they've proved value of over $200 on the evidence.
They've proved value of over $200 on the evidence. And that shows about, I'm not very good at math, I think it shows about three quarters, about 75% depreciation from 800 and something dollars down to over $200,
roughly
about that. And that is a considerable amount of depreciation on this record. Now, so that changes the issue to whether any reasonable fact finder could make that finding. And that is a difficult burden to say on appeal for the defendant. And our position on appeal, Commonwealth's position on appeal, is that the trial court's finding was not without evidence to support it and was not plainly wrong. If there's more questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Hearing none, we thank you very much, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you very much.
Mr. O'Gara, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party, the Commonwealth, did the court reconsider and decide, well, there was testimony, notwithstanding as early as striking the evidence?
I do not believe. I think it's important to make a distinction between a court reconsidering its early ruling to strike testimony and accepting new evidence that was just given to it. And I think that it's clear from the record that what he did in this case was to not reconsider, but to accept the new testimony from the owner, which was, he said, based solely upon, you know, your opinion as its owner, what's the value? And he accepted that. He did not reconsider his prior ruling, especially since that, and that's important because the fact that he gave it as his own opinion, that was one of the reasons that he had initially sustained the objection, because first testimony included information that someone else had given him. So I do not think he reconsidered his prior ruling. I think he accepted the new testimony of the owner. And I think the statement that's made on page 64, line 14 and 15, just because he used the term over $200, I don't think that incorporates the original statement. If it had been some other figure, it might send us in that direction, but $200 is the statutory amount. So all they have to prove is that it's over $200. So whether he, I don't think that bears on whether he was reinstating the original evidence. I think he was just accepting new testimony. Just kind of by way of wrap up, I think sometimes as lawyers and judges, we can get a little bit wrapped up in the fine legal points of things, and sometimes we miss the forest from the trees. And I think we're in danger of doing that in this case, perhaps. I think if we look at it just from a little bit of distance, that in a world where you can go down to Best Buy and for $200 buy whatever their weekly special is and have a laptop that's new, that is guaranteed to work, that has a battery, it has a power cord, and perhaps most importantly of all, does not have roaches, dead, alive, or frozen. In that world, no reasonable buyer who is not forced to buy is going to pay $200 or more for this laptop. And we would just ask the court to both consider all of our legal arguments, and that in this case, I rarely argue it, but I think under the evidence, the judge was plainly wrong in his decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In keeping with our